At JCPenney, we know you miss us, and we miss you. So, what if we said we had a store that's open all day, every day? We do. It's jcp.com or the JCPenney app. Need a swimsuit? We've got them. Something new and cute for summer? Look no further. Exclusive JCPenney brands, plus your favorite national brands? Yes and yes. Check our site for the latest coupons, and when you spend $49 or more, standard shipping is free. JCPenney. Exclusions apply. See jcp.com for details.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to UFO Undercover. We're not exactly sure what happened. It looked like a lightning strike took out the main studio for a little while. For everybody in New Orleans, I know y'all got picked up by the override service, so y'all were probably listening to another show or music. But anyway, you're back with us now. So if you're having a problem listening, guys, remember you can always catch us in the chat room, Spreaker, SoundCloud. The main server should be coming up in just a minute. So y'all should be able to catch us off the website itself. Give it about 2 minutes and it'll be coming up if you're listening via another thing right now. I know there's a lot of different ways to listen. And for everybody overseas and on different servers, outbound servers, usually takes 2 or 3 minutes for them to populate from us because we have to populate first and then their servers catch back up. I already see the Hong Kong servers lighting up as we're talking. So I see the British, actually the London server is lighting up too. Good morning, by the way, London. What is it, like 1 a.m. over there right now? Hey, happy morning time for y'all. And yes, I agree, John. I see in the chat room right now, it's Canada. No, for Americans, we consider that Annex Day. Yes, we annex Canada. We just never told y'all. Yeah, you didn't know that? You didn't hear me talk? By the way, Robert, I got quite a few Canadian hosts on the network. The show following us, both as Michelle, Michelle DeRoche, who's from Canada's Most Haunted, and Amelia Cassano, they host the Outer Realm out of Niagara Falls. So they're following us, and they're both Canadians. And we have quite a few Canadians, I think 6 or 8 on the network these days. And for some reason, the last 2 weeks, we've been on a Canadian guest role. I'm not sure. I don't know how that works. It just happens sometimes. We get a particular thing going. It's not like the different hosts are booking it on purpose. It just is the way it works out. But anyway, guys, welcome back, everybody. I have Robert J. Soria with me, and we're going to try to get through some of his books. I know we're down to an hour now, but I will be bringing him back on because he sounds like somebody I want to talk to about sci-fi because I really like my sci-fi. Anybody who's listened to the show for more than a year knows I really like my sci-fi. But let me get this main server on. And all right, now you can listen to us from the websites, guys. So be sure to check in there, and or Spreaker or YouTube. Sorry about that, Robert. That was a little on the weird side, actually.
Never had that before, but we survive. Weird. We survive, yes, and succeed.
It was very weird. And what do you mean, Chris? Oh, you're looking at the book on his mantle, on his whatever that is back there sitting on. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about? Well, what do you want to know? The title's on it.
It is. But I never cut off a man who's asking about my book there. That, sir, is the Oppenheimer Alternative, my latest novel.
This might be good. Here it is. I like this. Right, I might have to get this one.
The Oppenheimer Alternative by Robert J. Soria. My 24th novel, just out in, of course, print, audiobook, ebook, you name the format, I'm there.
I'll get an audiobook so I can listen in my car because I get a commute every day. So,
yeah, the audiobook is terrific. Wonderful guy named Josh Bloomberg reading the audiobook. He's doing a great job.
What do you mean? No, we're not telling you what's in a book. Go get it. The name should kind of give you an idea what a book's about. You don't recognize the title, the name and the title. Well, I'm not even going to go there. You know what I tell you? Get the book, and then you know what he's talking about. How's that? You it's want about, a thrill? You want a sneak peek? Can you give him a sneak peek?
Sure. It's about J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. And as the alternative in the title suggests, it's an alternate history. So it deals with, of course, the real historical events that happened 75 years ago this summer. And in fact, in 2 weeks, it'll be the 75th anniversary of the first atomic bomb explosion at the Trinity test site near Alamogordo, New Mexico. And next month will be the 75th anniversary, the only times ever that atomic weapons have been used against civilian populations, bombing of Hiroshima, the bombing of Nagasaki. Oppenheimer never had an opportunity to redeem himself in real life. He was very guilt-ridden after the death of all those people because of his invention. And I give him kind of a second kick at the can to maybe find a way to make it all, make his life anyways to have counted for some good in the end, not just some bad.
See, and I'm glad you brought that, because a lot of people, you know, right off the bat, people, I see somebody in the chat room, well, Einstein, but everybody see, but that's not true. Einstein worked on the bomb. And I, by the way, there were several scientists involved with the nuclear weapons program. It's just for some reason, you know, Oppenheimer got some press, but for some reason, Einstein got more. I don't know why. I wasn't there. I couldn't honestly tell you why the media favored one over the other. But if you read your history, it's not really hard to find out what Robert's talking about. Like I said, I'm a science geek, and I do have a bachelor's in science, so I'm a little bit more familiar with this. And I have had guests on like Michio Kaku, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Paul Levesque with quantum kinetics. And so I do a lot of science, which I usually keep those for special shows because, you know, a lot of the audience, if it's hard on a layman audience sometimes when we get in too deep a science. And when I have like Michio on, we try to keep it as dumbed down as possible because some of it's above my head as well. I'm not going to lie to y'all, but it's just, you know, it gets a little much sometimes when we get too deep into science. So, but in this case, you know, this guy was a brilliant, it's unfortunate. His most biggest claim to fame killed, what was it, 50,000 in one city and 250,000 in the other city. Actually, guys, I get them confused, but Hiroshima is Nagasaki. They actually missed. It actually hit in the valley next to the city. Yeah. And still killed 50,000 people. For some reason, I always flip-flop the two over. I don't know why I do that. It must be a Freudian thing. The other one, though, unfortunately, killed a lot of people, devastated a city. There's lots of – if you're really interested in it, ladies and gentlemen, there's lots of photos, believe it or not, of what happened at Hiroshima, from people's dresses being tattooed on their bodies permanently to all sorts of other nasty things. And believe it or not, there were a lot of survivors. A lot more dead, but a lot of the survivors. Hopefully, we in our lifetimes, we never see this again. Nuclear weapons are nasty things, and look, it did bring the war to a close. You know, it probably saved another 250,000 lives because it did bring it to a close. But you know, it was a hell of a way to do it. I really was. What do you mean we were justified? They didn't kill 250,000 people at Pearl Harbor. I'm just saying, guys, it's not exactly what happened. And a majority of our troops were not always weren't lost to the Japanese. They were lost in the European theater. Don't get me wrong, we lost a lot. In the Pacific theater too, but not as many. Yeah, no, you don't have to take my word. All this you can look up for yourselves. Now, Crystal just asked, what was your favorite book that you've written?
Oh, that I've written myself?
That you've written yourself.
I would be an idiot to say anything other than the Oppenheimer alternative. And that's even true. It's even true. It was 4 years since my previous book. My previous book was called Quantum Night. Night-like as opposed to day, as opposed, you know, not night as of the round table, Quantum Night. And I thought that was the best book I'd ever written. I thought it was the capstone of my career. I thought I was done. And I told people I was retiring at that point. And this idea took hold of me. The idea, as, you know, one of the great professors of English literature, Northrop Frye, said many, many years ago, all literature is ultimately about redemption. It's about the character finding some way to make up for their own failings, for something they've done, for how they've wronged somebody. They start off on the wrong side of history, they end up on the right side, whether it's their personal history or whether it's history as written in history books. And what I realized was that in real life, there was this compelling character of J. Robert Oppenheimer, whose story just cried out for a redemption sort of narrative. And I spent more time on this book. Now, you can do the math yourself. 30 years I've been a novelist. This is my 24th book. I spent 4 years on this book. I couldn't have spent 4 years a book on the previous 23, not and gotten them done in just decades. So this was the biggest project I ever undertook in terms of the research, in terms of the time it took to write, the number of drafts to get it just right. And it also is completely a standalone novel. So it's not, I'm not going to tell you, you know, start one of my, I've got three trilogies. Don't start with a trilogy. Start with this. It's a standalone. If you like what I do, I got lots of other things to offer you. They're all different, but they're all Robert J. Sawyer in one sense or another. But this is a perfectly good one to start with, and it is my favorite, The Oppenheimer Alternative.
You know, I just like the title of it myself because it is nice to give him an alternative, another way out or a redemption. I like that idea of redemption too, by the way. Because I would think, you know, if he was alive today, he would probably want to, or try to figure out how to.
Yeah. Okay. This titles are funny because we tried many out. You know, as one can very easily these days on social media. I'd put up, well, do you like this title? Do you like that title? People would vote. Did the same thing with the cover art and so forth. You get a lot of you know, marketing research feedback is free these days instead of having to, you know, hire a firm at six or seven figures to do the study for you. But you're right. You know, Oppie died at 62 years of age. He was a chain smoker. It was nothing nefarious. It was just he was his own worst enemy through his whole life, including chain smoking for over four decades, 4 to 5 pack a day, man. And he died at 62. Horrible death from, in his case, throat cancer was what actually took him away. And there, you just cough on us, Joe, right there, right?
Well, I gave him cigarettes about 12 years ago.
Well, but, good for you, right? Good for you. But he couldn't. He tried. Actually, he did. But near the end, he did manage to break cigarettes, but not tobacco. He was still a pipe smoker on the day he died. And 62 years of age, you know, I'm not yet 62, but I'm in spitting distance of that.
Yeah, but in today's world, that's not old. You know, that's when I was a kid growing up, that was old. But today, that's not old.
No, that's right. And I know from my father, who passed away at 93, you spent a lot of time in your later years regretting the things you did wrong earlier in life. If you can make amends, that's good. But if your people you wronged are dead, right, you can't. And so you want to have that opportunity. You want at the end of your life, the karmic scale to be pretty much in balance. And not everybody gets that opportunity.
That's true. That's true. Actually, for me, the station's kind of a redemption for me. It allows me to help out people without, you know, it's a weird business because you can actually help people out without having to get as involved as you would if you're face to face. It's a strange thing, but, you know, we'll offer airtime to different groups or we'll bring them on and question different things. And we got a show coming up in the near future that's going to be a very heated show. This is a group from BLM that's protesting right now, and a white group saying, why can't they say this, that, and this? So it's going to be a crazy show. Hopefully everybody will be real honest. Fortunately, a lot of these guys know each other. They've worked on a station or still working on the station. So they will have to be somewhat respectful because they're still going to have to deal with each other down the line. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, we've had them both on opposite and talking about it. So now we're going to put them together and see if we can have a real honest conversation. So and it may change something. It may not, people. Who knows for sure? You know, I've interviewed some pretty big names in my time, including Rachel Madcow Maddow is what I call her nowadays, because lately she's been on a rant, so I don't try to watch her anymore. She's been kind of crazy. Actually, dudes, I stay away from normal media as much as I can because it's not news anymore. It's opinions. It's not – if you turn on the news today in this country, when I was growing up, we had the likes of Walter Cronkite and others. They did news. They got on, wow, this happened today and da-da-da-da-da, and all this went on. They didn't tell you what they thought about it or what could have happened or who was responsible. They said, this is the news. And you formulated your own damn opinion. Well, that's not how it is today. Today it is. Let me serve you an opinion, and then you can try to argue it out later on.
There's a lot of truth to that. But I got to say, the turning point in America and Vietnam was Walter Cronkite when he just took off his glasses. You may remember it. You're about my age. Took off his glasses one night and just shook his head after the report that he had to read out of Vietnam. And suddenly Uncle Walter, the guy who you're absolutely right, would say at the end of the day, that's the way it was, July 1st, 1967, right? He would say it with that gravitas. Uncle Walter, as everybody called him, a CBS news anchor. But when, as Nixon had to say, when we lost Walter Cronkite, we lost the war in the sense of having any American public support for it anymore.
Yeah, it really is a shame that's how it went. I mean, it really is. It bites. I mean, there was a couple others that we lost that were good, but today it's not what it is. Today it's just, let me tell you my opinion and move on. And I get tired of listening to it. And I tell people all the time, even on my shows, I tell people, because people get confused when I tell them, well, do your own homework. Do your research. You don't have to take me at my word. You have the internet now. Go look it up. See what's important. What are you asking, Christopher? Oh, no, I'm sorry, Dean. What are you asking? Hey, I didn't mean to step over you. Who's his favorite sci-fi writer, and what's his favorite sci-fi TV show? Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask him, Robert.
Sure. My favorite science fiction writer, and this is, you know, we all have our regrets, as I was mentioned, is one I never met. Arthur C. Clarke. He passed away not that long ago. And, you know, he lived in Sri Lanka. He had left the United Kingdom. He was born in Minehead, the United Kingdom, in 1908, I think it was. And he moved to Sri Lanka. And, of course, as with most people born in 1908, he's dead, right? Passed away. But he was my favorite, starting with my first introduction to his work, 2001, A Space Odyssey. But apropos of this particular show we're on right now, this discussion of UFOs, Clarke was the first person I encountered who said you could ask metaphysical questions in a science fiction context. You didn't have to be 100% closed-minded, rigorous, skeptic about anything. You could say, okay, bring me your evidence. Show me what you got. I'm curious. I want to know. I've got an open mind. And 2001, of course, which is a film about extraterrestrials having contacted us in our ancient past. It is, you know, on message with ancient aliens, whatever one might believe about the truth or lack of truth of that particular model. That's what Clarke was exploring in 2001. Were extraterrestrials interventionist, even not just here to visit, have a look around, interventionist in our past? That's what 2001 explores. Arthur C. Clarke, would have loved to have met him. Now, you asked favorite TV show today. I'm an optimist, and we've been talking here a little bit, Joe, about how crazy the world is right now, and it certainly is a fractious time, a difficult time, and so many of my colleagues write dystopian science fiction, negative futures. It's going to go from the bad we're in now to even worse in the days, weeks, months, and years to come. I'm an optimist. And so Star Trek has always been it for me. And the most recent incarnation is Star Trek Picard. But just before that, we had the first two seasons of Star Trek Discovery. And that's what it's all about, discovering our future, discovering where we can go together as a species, discovering our destiny. That's my favorite science fiction show on TV these days, Star Trek Discovery.
You know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I do. When I talk about Discovery, this is how I talk about it. I think it's a great sci-fi, but I don't think it's Star Trek. I got to be honest about this. And neither does Roddenberry's son. He said that the writers have forgotten what Star Trek is. It's about optimism for the future. The new Star Treks are not preaching that. They're preaching nastiness in the future. So he actually took – but I got to be honest about this, because I like Discovery. I don't want people to get the wrong idea here. Discovery is a great sci-fi show. And with the addition of Captain Pike at the end of the series, you may be able to twist it back into a real Star Trek. Yeah, I know about the spore drive. Everybody always writes me, oh, mushroom drive. I'm like, you can't take it as literal as you like. You got to remember, first off, this is written for younger generations than myself and Robert. It's more for the Z-geners, and they're trying, and the Z-geners are used to this kind of depression type stuff. So I like Discovery. I would recommend anybody watch it. If you're a hardcore Star Trek fan, don't take it as gospel. That's all I can tell you. I think they're moving, you know, they're going to move away from that now, because they reset it into the future so they can get away with some stuff that they shouldn't have been doing before with it. But I like the show. I'm not going to lie to y'all. I like Picard. I like that they brought in 7 of 9. I thought that was a great addition to it. I like the Romulan young man they brought in. I thought that was a great addition. I agree, Marty. It was a little slow in the start, but I think, you know, you got to remember, Picard's not a young man, okay? He's, what, 80-something, almost 90, I think. So, you know, this is a lot of work for him. And I think in the very beginning, I think people got the wrong impression when they seen him. They were like, well, he's just a little old man. He's blah, 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 blah. No. He's still Picard. And you see Picard come out on him in several times in this show. But I like Discovery. The writing's pretty good. The special effects are pretty good. The ship's pretty good. It's just you got to kind of leave it out of the Star Trek genre, because it kind of takes a left turn on the Star Trek genre. And it does paint a more depressing future than what Roddenberry, not what Gene would like. So, but hey, It's fun to watch. I enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. I'm waiting for the next season to come out. So take it for what you want. You get two people here that both like it. So I would at least try it out. How's that? If you haven't seen it yet, it's available on, what is it, ABC? Is it ABC
CBS.
CBS?
CBS. CBS All Access, their streaming service. Various places around the world. For instance, it's on Netflix in most foreign markets. And in Canada, it's on Space, which is our science fiction specialty channel. It varies from market to market. Yeah. But the principal audience is the American audience, and that's CBS All Access, which also has Picard and has the new animated Star Trek series, Star Trek Lower Decks. I think that even starts this month or next
month. I thought it was sometime in the next month. That's what
I've seen promos for it. And, you know, I'm friends with Rod Roddenberry, who's Gene's son. You're absolutely right. Rod has his concerns. And I think one of the things that they've taken to heart, I think, is they're listening to a lot of the feedback from fans. The people running the show are very sensitive to social media. They realize that they've got a product that they have to sell on an ongoing basis. And I do think you mentioned the addition of Captain Pike and bringing it back. I really think that when they brought Pike and Spock and Number One from the first pilot of the original Star Trek back into the series, I really think that that was a course correction, a very significant course correction. And of course, we are going to get a Star Trek Captain Pike TV series. It's going to be called, what the hell is it going to be called? Star Trek Strange New Worlds. Yeah.
And I think if they use the same guy, I think it'll be great. He's a great Pike.
They have signed him. Absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful actor. Anson Mount is his name.
And it's about time because, you know, I'm used to having three Star Trek series running.
Yeah, yes,
we got used to that with Voyager, Generations, and Deep Space Nine. So
that's right.
And then, you know, Enterprise. Well, I liked Enterprise, Chris. Well, you know, it was the first time I ever seen him put a famous person as a captain. Kirk – I forgot his name. How can I forget Kirk's real name?
William Shatner.
William Shatner was a little famous before he took on his role in Enterprise. He had been in things like, he'd been in a couple of movies. He had been in, what's the old one where it was always crazy stuff? My brain is going tonight. I didn't know to tell Rob, we're like psychic in here tonight. Yeah, I love that episode where he's looking out the window on an airplane. It's just a lot of fun to watch him. And he's kind of grown over the years himself. But, you know, I liked the new Enterprise. He had only got four seasons. And it did take some liberties here and there. But it was fun to watch. I know it was hard for some of y'all because the science, the effects on the old Enterprise were better than the effects on the new Enterprise. But, hey, that's progress, people. That's all you can do. I mean, back in the day, the special effects weren't as good as they are today. So you got to deal with that part. But it stays in line with what it's supposed to. And like Deep Space Nine, traveling back in space to the space station where Kirk was with the Romulans, you know, the Tribble episode. That was classic. I mean, that was a good episode. They didn't take too many liberties there. I enjoyed things like that. And I like when they crisscross. All right. Marsha wants to know if you like the new Star Trek movies, because they kind of changed everything up.
So, you know, we say new, but they're getting a little long in the tooth now. The first one was 2009, and it just has the title Star Trek. Yep. So we always have to have a nickname for it to distinguish it from Star Trek, the TV series. People call it J.J. Trek after J.J. Abrams, who directed it, for instance, or Star Trek 2009. First, I'll say I loved the casting. And in some ways, that was their hardest challenge. You've got to find a new Kirk, a new Spock, a new McCoy, that triumvirate in particular.
And they did a good job with that.
Don't you agree, Joe? Yes. Unbelievable how well they did it. Chris Pine looks like William Shatner. He had the bravado and yet a little bit of a vulnerable side. Yeah. Zachary Quinto, who, of course, spent a lot of time with Leonard Nimoy. Nimoy is in the first film and the second one. You know, they became great friends. And I think Quinto really understood, maybe even more than Chris Pine did, that this was almost a passing of the torch, anointing of him as the designated successor. And who would have thought that Carl Urban would have been Dr. McCoy, this Australian actor? who had never done a part remotely like that. And yet he absolutely nails the cynicism, the crusty exterior with the real warm, soft heart inside. The casting was brilliant. The art direction, it's a different take on it. It's very shiny and bright, all those lens flares. The music by Michael Giacchino is brilliant. And the first film I really enjoyed. The second film suffered enormously because for whatever insane reason, they decided to essentially remake and invert The Wrath of Khan.
I know, and that then, was just dumb.
You know, and whitewash it. Khan is a Sikh. Yeah. And whitewash it with Benedict Cumberbatch playing the part. So the film, that film, the second one is so conceptually flawed. It's hard to forgive. The third film I quite enjoyed again, Star Trek Beyond. Yeah. So will there be a fourth? That's what we're all on kind of tenterhooks for.
Yeah.
Originally there was going to be. And then, of course, since Star Trek 2009, Chris Pine has become a superstar thanks to the Wonder Woman films, the Marvel Universe, and Chris Hemsworth.
She plays what's her name on Galaxy?
Oh, Zoe Saldana. Yes.
Yeah. She's doing pretty well for herself these days. And then there's a couple of them that's made it pretty big out of this.
They wanted the big bucks money, right? Yeah. Chris Pine wanted $20 million to be in Star Trek, which is what he gets for a Marvel movie. Well, Star Trek isn't as big. And Chris Hemsworth, who was the new film, was supposed to feature Kirk's father, right? Kirk's father, George Kirk. And he also is a huge, he's Thor in the Marvel movies. He wanted $20 million. Well, you're talking $40 million for your two actors before you get to Zachary Quinto. It was a non-starter. And I always think, you know, I know it's the agents. The actors just stay out of it. It's the agents. But I always think actors have an obligation to people who were with them early on. You know, in Star Trek, in Enterprise, which you mentioned, James Cromwell, who had just been a character actor and got one of his big breaks as a movie actor playing Zefram Cochrane in the movie First Contact, the first Star Trek The Next Generation film, and then won an Academy Award for playing the farmer in Babe and suddenly was a huge actor, came back and did a cameo as Zefram Cochrane in Enterprise for just, you know, scale, just regular money. Why? Because the Star Trek franchise had employed him when no one else would, hardly anybody else was. I think there's a question of loyalty that that Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth and their agents should come back and say, you guys weren't huge stars when Star Trek broke you out. And now that you are, come back and pay back a little bit. Don't turn your back. You don't climb over people on your way to the top. You take the people along with you as you go forward.
I agree wholeheartedly. Oh, no, Gene. Uhura didn't play Nebula. You know who played Nebula? I bet you'll never guess who played Nebula. I will tell you she's been on TV and she has been in movies and she was in a very popular television series. Her character's name was Amy Pond. That's who played Nebula, in case y'all didn't know that. What's her name? Uhura played what's his name's girlfriend? Damn, like that. See, man, I'm losing it. God, I can't believe I can't remember that. Oh, what was her name? We all should know by now.
The actress is Zoe Saldana.
Yeah, that's the name. Actually, I was just thinking of part she played in Galaxy Quest. The Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, I got Galaxy Quest on the brain for some reason.
She was about eight when Galaxy Quest
came out, I know. Oh, no, she's a lot of fun. She's a fun actress. And you didn't like the interaction with her and Spock? I kind of like that.
Yeah, very
I thought that was a kind of catch your breath moment when her and Spock kiss. Sorry, I didn't say him, but I think they took that to a different level. Well, I know you're upset about it because she hooks up with Scotty way later in some 7 or 8 movie in Star Trek, but you know, she's young here, so that don't mean she can't hook up with Spock now. So, you know, and I think they played that well. I really liked the first one, you know. Yeah, it bites that they blew up Vulcan, but other than that, I enjoyed the movie. I agree with what Robert said about the second one. It was just, It was a jibber jabber movie. How you like that? Yeah, I mean, it was just bouncing around, and it was a lot of stuff that was just out of balance in that movie. And I've said this about Abrams before. I said he should always be allowed to make the first movie, but the rest of the movies should be, because he did the same thing with Star Wars. He did a good movie, and then all of a sudden he kind of gets a little overdone in him or something. I don't know how to explain it, but it gets a little crazy, I think.
Lost. Let's think about Lost, which starts out very strong and ends very weak, right? Of course, he was the guy behind, the producer, director behind Lost, Damien Lindelof, of course, also a key character in there. But this is his pattern, isn't it? He goes in with enormous enthusiasm, and then there's a little bit of paint by numbers as he goes along with it. He's got, you know, for a director, a film director needs an attention span, okay, maybe of 9 months, 10 months to make a film. Yeah. A film franchise leader needs an attention span of years or decades. Yeah, the reason like James Bond did so well is that Cubby Broccoli, who was the mastermind behind the James Bond series, kept that flame alive through X number of actors playing it through, you know, decades. It was the first film franchise starting in, what was it, 62 with the first Bond film, and still going strong. We're going to have the 50th anniversary Bond film. It's going to be the next one. You got to have somebody who's got legs, not just lens flares, but legs.
Yeah, you got to be able to see ahead. So that was always my downside about Abrams. I mean, because with Star Wars, he kind of went the same way. And I was like, dude, come on now. I mean, you've got all kind. You know, when you've got the genre of Star Wars and Star Trek, you should have endless imagination. I mean, it's an open genre that can go in all kinds. Yeah, there's some guidelines you got to stick to, but you know, still, I mean, you can get away with a lot of stuff in these two things, but I don't know. He just seems, and I think they're replacing him now, but, and I mean, as far as Star Wars goes, it's done. Oh, there'll be standalone movies, but the 9 books that were originally written are all gone and done now. This is over. We're moving on from that now. So, and I watched, what was it? It was one of the, I didn't like the first one because everybody died in it, the first spinoff of Star Wars, Rogue One. And I kind of did at first, and then I was kind of like, I don't know. I went back and forth on it, to be honest with you. Are you going to call it the Chewbacca movie? Well, anyway, that one was okay. I mean, well, there was nowhere they could really go wrong with that movie because there was no genre about him in the beginning. So they could do whatever they wanted. They could say we came from wherever and did whatever. And the actress in that movie was pretty famous. It wasn't bad. It wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. A lot of these movies, people put too much emphasis on the genre. So it just depends how it's being written and how it's being sold. And then you can kind of take what you want to take out of it. But I don't know, most of the movies I like, I'm not going to say they're all great and beyond belief, but what's like, it's like Guardians of the Galaxy. I loved the first one. The second one, I was kind of like, special effects and all. I don't know. Like I said, I go back and forth a lot on movies. So it's kind of like all the Marvel movies. Some of them are really good. Some of them you're like, what happened here? Like the very last one. The part one was pretty good. Part two was a little thrown together like they were in a rush to get it out. Avatar. Did you watch Avatar?
Sure, of course I did. Because everybody said it was the greatest thing ever made. I didn't see it opening day. And what's funny about it is how little we remember of it at this late date. Right? It came out the same year as that first J.J. Abrams Star Wars film, 2009. And of course we were all blown away. The special effects were, very, very interesting.
Very, very good.
But you know, there wasn't much meat on the bones. It was, okay, absolutely, yes, we should respect indigenous peoples, right? But we got that, in the movie that he remade, which was Dances with Wolves. We'd already, had that movie. It's a lesson that we have to hear over and over again, 100%. But it is, and you gotta listen to the forest creatures and look after the environment. Well, again, all right. But it was not in any way as special a story as the special effects it was wrapped up in.
That's very
true. Now Cameron keeps talking about, I'm going to make, more of them. Who cares at this point, Jimmy?
Do you know they've got seven of them slated, and each one's going to take 3 to 4 years to make?
Yeah. You know,
I'm like, come on now. But you know what? Disney's got a problem, and so a couple of them, because now that they took Yosemite Sam's guns away, they're going to have to take all their big movies guns. Can you imagine Marvel without guns?
Yeah.
I don't know, guys. I think they might have overreacted a little bit here, but Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's just last season's, guys. It's and I go wave back and forth on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Sometimes I like it. Sometimes I'm like, oh, my God, what am I watching? I'm just telling you, this is how I feel about it. Sometimes some of the stuff I've liked, some of it not so much. It's a you want to know? Okay, Bruce is right, and he wanted to know if you have you seen Altered Carbon yet.
So you know what? I have not. Richard Morgan, of course, it's based on his books. I'm somewhat familiar with the underlying intellectual property, but I haven't seen it. But everybody says it's great, and it's just I'm a little bit behind on some of my present day science fiction. But I hear it's wonderful.
I liked it, but I'm going to be honest with you. Don't let your kids watch it. There's a lot of porn in this thing. That's the only way I can call it. There's a lot of sex, a lot of naked people. That's all I can tell y'all. But some of the premises is pretty good. But there's another don't mess with indigenous species, because when they go to the second season and they go back to the home where all this started, it kind of gives you that kind of feel. There's a lot of good stuff in it because you can jump bodies and switch bodies. You can be male or female. I mean, there's a lot of lessons in this. But it's not overly politically correct. So, yeah, the special effects are pretty good. Some of the writing is pretty good. Some of the writing, you know, when you're writing a series, you're going to have good episodes. You're going to have bad episodes. That's just part of writing a series. Not every Star Trek episode was a great episode. And some are much better than others. But it's just part of it. Bruce, what are you writing about, Bruce? Wait, what? Oh, favorite sci-fi. No. Last of the Mohicans was not a sci-fi movie. What the hell, man? Not that it wasn't a bad movie, but I'm just saying it wasn't sci-fi. Oh, my wife loves Last of the Mohicans. Oh, yeah. She's made me listen to the soundtrack more times. I probably knew the damn thing by heart. She always did that. And it's like, you know, when he's up there, my friend and I am, there's a lot of good scenes in the movie. Dances with Wolves, there's some pretty good scenes in the movie. Even though Kevin Costner's not the greatest actor on the planet, he did a good job in the movie, so... well, you know, he's been better in than other things. That's just part of sci-fi. But I do agree with what you just said, Michael, and I'll ask Robert if he does. I for me, there should always be a little comedy in all sci-fi. Even because one of the reasons I didn't like Battlestar Galactica, the remake, is it was just too serious for me. You know, I was taken back because it doesn't matter how bad things get for humans, somewhere along the line somebody's gonna crack a joke. You know, somebody's gonna do something stupid.
So we mentioned at the outset Dune, because a couple of our judges at Writers of the Future are the people currently writing Dune. Frank Herbert's son, Brian, and his writing partner, Kevin J. Anderson. And I love Dune. You just said you love Dune. But the thing that's not fun about Dune is it's not fun. Nobody ever cracks a joke. There's no humor. There's no wit. Even in the most ridiculous of situations, man, if I'm riding on top of a giant worm as if I was surfing off of Malibu, I would have a few jokes to come out of my, you know,
my mouth. Only funny moment I can remember in the whole movie is when Patrick Stewart said, "I'll go out in the desert like a wild ass." That was it. I mean, I'm not kidding y'all, guys. That is really the only light anything in this. This movie is a serious movie. And, well, no, the remakes are different. And they're done a little lighter and they're done a little different than the original Dune. Dune was meant to be a serious, hardcore movie, and it's almost 3 hours long.
Right.
So, I mean, you got to sit down and watch it. And if you watch it a couple dozen times, you're going to see a lot of things in it. But there's a lot of darkness in this movie. So if you're not into that, you might not want to watch it. I enjoyed it, but I took it for what it was. But with Battlestar, you know, if you're going to do a series and you're going to be making me watch every week, I'm going to expect you to crack a joke here and there just to offset some of the mean stuff that's going on. Well, you know, one of my favorite things is I remember one of the prisoners of war who came back from Vietnam was talking about one of the ways they stayed sane was to crack jokes because they were being tortured fairly regularly. So we know in stress, humans use, you know, comedy or just to help relax. So I just want to see more of it in sci-fi. I really would. We'll see how the new ones are. No, they crack jokes in Discovery. Oh, yeah, they do. Picard, they do too. Not as many as they could, but still they do. Oh, you didn't like Picard because of the language? Yeah, well, I know Roddenberry's don't curse in his, but, you know, something y'all going to have to deal with now. For some reason, currently, Hollywood and them think that cursing helps sell movies. I'm not sure what the hell that's about, but, yeah, I can deal with it as long as it's not the F word. I'm pretty good with it. Well, that's one of the things that bothered me about Discovery is when the little chunky blonde used the F word. Roddenberry must have flipped over in his grave, man. I guarantee he was not happy about that. I mean, he was hardcore about, no, I want to present a particular type future where people are equal, people love each other, people want to help each other. And Discovery's a little ways from there, but Discovery, again, is good sci-fi. Don't sell it off because it's not your perfect picture of Star Trek. That's all I can tell y'all. You can probably find Robert's books everywhere, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the question of the hour there. My novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative, my latest, should be in all your favorite bookstores. If it's not, any bookstore can special order it and have it for you in a couple of days. The Oppenheimer Alternative by Robert J. Sawyer. But, of course, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Please, if you have an independent bookstore that you love, go to them. And if they don't have it, they will be happy to get it for you. You know, it's a little known secret, but any independent bookstore can get any book. So you can walk into your favorite kids' bookstore and order a technical manual. You can walk into, you know, a gay and lesbian bookstore and say, I want, you know, the History of China, whatever you want. Any bookstore can order any book. They've got accounts with the distributors, and that's what matters. So The Oppenheimer Alternative is distributed by Ingram in the United States. And of course, audiobook is at Audible and iTunes and everywhere you might get Audible audiobooks. And the ebook is at Amazon and Kobo and Nook and Apple Books and whoever you like to get your audiobooks or your ebooks from. The Oppenheimer Alternative.
Karina writes in, she's talking about Battlefield Earth. Now, Karina, in a lot of ways, I agree with you. What happened was, obviously, you haven't read the book. So let me start by saying, if you want to know what really went on in Battlefield Earth, read the book. What happened with the movie is it was already 3 hours long. From what I understand, they cut out more than an hour of the movie because it just wasn't going to make the screen. That's why you've seen stuff like the guys learning to fly the airplane overnight and stuff. There was a lot of stuff. They just didn't have a choice. You know, if they wanted to get this onto the screen, there were certain things that they had to kind of move around so they could get it on it. It was just, it really should have been like a two-part movie, maybe 2.5 hours on each side. And I think it would have been a much better movie. I know there's a lot about the movie I like. There's a lot of stuff about the movie I didn't like, but still, there, you know, if you read the book, you'll really get a better sense of it. That's why a lot of people tell you sometimes a movie will justify the book or even do better. Most times a movie will just not be as good as the book because stuff you put in a book sometimes does not translate well onto the big screen. So you have to keep that in mind. But I would suggest read it. I imagine you can get it anywhere these days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's 100% Battlefield Earth is in print. And it's a massive book, as you say. And the thing about a massive book, you look at Lord of the Rings or the original Dune, you look at these massive works and what The problems with Battlefield Earth as a movie is the same problem with Dune as a movie. It's too much.
It's too
for
much.
90 minutes to 2 hours. And if you try to do the highlights, the skim across the surface, you leave the audience baffled. Thank goodness that the Lord of the Rings films did so well that, you know, when they came to do Hobbit, they even did Hobbit, which is not that big a book, as multiple books. A realization that the best way to treat adapting a literary work is not to say, okay, how do we pare it down to its bare bones until all that's left is a skeleton with no heart, no brain, no muscle, just a skeleton, and cram that into the window we have in a theater. The best way these days adapting is probably adapting for television. Or for a trilogy of films, you get 8, 10, 12 hours on TV to treat a book. That's a very, you can do it. You can do the nuance, do all the characters.
I agree. I mean, it's just a shame. No, Stephanie, I read all the, I read a lot of the classics when I was in private school, like Where the Red Fern Grows and stuff like that. But it's just, you know, I didn't even know there was a book for Gone with the Wind. I didn't know there was a book for what's the one when they're singing all over? Oh, it's out of my head. But When they went to, it was a set in German town, Germany town. And
that's The Sound of Music, my friend.
Thank you. How can I forget that? I didn't know what it was.
I'm just here to be your auxiliary memory.
Thank God, man, because my brain is fried tonight. And but I had to read these. But when I got in the Navy, I needed something to distract me from, I was in electronics and avionics and I was cramming all the time. And in the Navy, you're not allowed to, you can't fail a test. You have to ace every test. If you miss one question, that's a failing mark. So you have to be on your game if you want to graduate. So I used to use these books. That's where I learned about Dune. That's why I wanted to see it when it came out. I read The Hobbits. I read all of the trilogy for Lord of the Rings. And yes, and Lord of the Rings, the books got more in them, but they really took their time with the three, and they put a lot of information in those movies. And of course, it didn't hurt that it had really good special effects. But they did a good job with them. And you mean J.K. Rowling? As long as we don't talk about J.K.'s politics, we're okay, all right? Her books are fine. Her movies are okay. I don't want to talk about her politics. Y'all leave me out of that discussion. I don't even want to go there. I'm not a huge fan of them. I mean, don't get me wrong. I enjoyed them. I've seen all of the Harry Potter movies, but I'm not that super fan like you see with other people. I enjoyed it. My kids liked it, but I went, you know, I'm not a witchy kind of guy. That's why. I like more science in my stuff. So that's why I like sci-fi as much as I do. Yeah, you can consider it sci-fi, I guess. I don't know. What do you think? Can you consider that sci-fi? I guess you sort of
Lord
could.
Of the Rings?
Yeah.
So this is a big question, and I would not consider it science fiction. Here's my distinction. It's very straightforward.
Good.
Science fiction is things that plausibly might happen. Fantasy is things that never could happen. So they're diametrically opposed. Now, they're often shelved in the same section of the bookstore because both of them are set in what we call secondary universes. They're not set in our present day here and now. They're set in some alternative version of reality. And they both prize imagination, world building, and so forth. But they really are two very distinctly different art forms. I don't say here, for the record, that one is better than the other. But if you catch me in the odd moment and, you know, we're relaxing over some Coke Zero in my case, I might let out that I happen to think that science fiction is a more important art form than fantasy.
I would agree.
I might be also a little bit biased there.
I would agree with that. I'm a much bigger sci-fi fan. I'm not even going to lie about it, but I enjoy a good sci-fi. It's anything, you know, well, if you like to escape, you know, fantasy is a good thing. If you want to escape Marvel, I mean, that's one of those things. What do you mean Robert likes dinosaurs?
I do. Oh, this is absolutely true. I wanted to be a vertebrate paleontologist. I wanted to devote my life to studying dinosaurs. And I've done a bunch of novels with paleontological themes, a trilogy about an alien world that dinosaurs were transplanted to before the extinction event at the end of the Cretaceous. And so they developed a modern civilization. And in the three books, Farseer, Fossil Hunter, and Foreigner, deal with three seminal figures in the evolution of science in our reality: Galileo, Darwin, and Freud. I did a time travel novel, End of an Era. Painting over my shoulder here that Bob Eggleton did is the cover art for End of an Era. For those few of you who are actually watching the video feed, I did a novel about a paleontologist facing his own mortality called Calculating God. It is absolutely, if we talk about alternate realities, alternate histories, if I were not a science fiction writer by profession, I would be a paleontologist. Love, love, love some dinosaurs. I have very few Lucky Charms on my in my writing space, but one right here that I hold in my hand, I'll describe it for the listeners, is a Stegosaurus rib. It's a rib fragment from a Stegosaurus, my favorite dinosaur. And I keep it, you saw, I'm right here. It's just right in what I call sitcom distance. On any sitcom, and people will say something like, oh, do you have the Farmer's Almanac, which nobody ever asks for out of the book? Yes, it's right here. They don't have to set up the shot differently. It's always within reaching distance. Do you have, you know, headache pills? Why, yes, they happen to be right beside me all the time. Well, here, it's my Stegosaurus rib really is in sitcom distance of where I sit and work all day long.
What was that, Mike? No, actually, if you're looking at us on Facebook right now, you can actually see a list of his books I have posted while we're talking. Those two videos, no, those are talking points of Robert and I. Yeah, I know they were playing earlier because I had them playing, but that's it because I was watching them. Y'all just got the benefit of watching them because I was watching them. Now, I see this one up here, Red Planet Blues. One, when I seen it, I was kind of curious about it, what it was. And then I was thinking, maybe you should write one on green versus reds, or reds versus greens. It's been a big thing in our society, but no one's really wrote any good books on it. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm talking about is it's been a big argument in science whether we should keep Mars pristine or make it a green world like this. So when you hear me say red versus green, red is the people who want to keep it pristine. Green is the people who want to convert it to be like Earth. And I just haven't seen any. I've seen like one book that was decent. Everything else I've read was just garbage.
And, well, the great book on this, the great trilogy, is Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. Blue meaning not just green, but also with oceans again. Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars by my great friend Kim Stanley Robinson. And not to give anything away about my novel, but on the cover, that's Mars at the top of the picture of the frame on the cover.
Oh, guys.
Mars is a very interesting issue because we have never come into an environment that has no life on it. Not even when we finally made it Antarctica. Of course, there are penguins and other things in Antarctica. We've never come into a pristine, biologically either never alive or now completely dead environment. Mars, it looks like, we may be pleasantly surprised and discover microbes or other things there still alive. But at the moment, we take it to be any life that did exist on Mars is gone. So does that give us a license to come in there and say, all right, let's start remaking this in the image of Earth? We have a term out of science fiction, by the way. Jack Williamson coined the term. It's terraforming. Terra being the Latin name for our planet. It just means Earth. Terra. Forming, making it into the form of. Terraforming. Do we have the set aside whether we've got the technical expertise? The answer is no, we don't. But we will eventually. There's nothing magical about bringing life to a dead world. Do we have the moral authority, the moral right, or is a beautiful, clean, pristine landscape something that we should preserve simply because it is beautiful and clean and pristine? A lot of interesting debate to go on there. As you said, Joe, it is a contentious issue. It's contentious at NASA. It's contentious at JPL. It's contentious among scientists. You have ecologically minded people on one side. You have the Elon Musks of the world who are very much industrialists on the other side. It's a very, very fraught issue and one that we will face in this millennium as a species.
You know, two things real quick. There's a series out about Mars that Elon Musk is in. This is a sci-fi series about colonization of Mars, and both from the government and from a private industry standpoint. But in this movie, from time to time, they cut to these scientists talking about colonizing of Mars. It's interesting, a little slow, but interesting. If you're not a big sci-fi fan or if you're not a big science fan, you might want to stay away from it, but it's pretty good. But what got me thinking was my very first interview I ever did with Arthur C. Clarke, which was, God, goes back quite some time. We used to help them out, him and the guy that used to work for him. I'm not going to take any things here because I don't know who this guy was. I mean, they were great friends, but there's lots of rumors. But regardless, we used to help. He used to get stuff from JPL in Milan and go through Mars's photos all the time. And we worked on one of the teams. And when the guy found out I did radio, I'm not mentioning his names because I don't know. I think he's still alive, the person I'm talking about, but I don't want to mention his name outright because he never told me I could. But anyway, one of the things we did was the glass tubes on Mars. So I had him on the show because we had seen these videos and a lot of people said, oh, they were sand waves and with this and that. But then you would see them bridging across cracks in the surface, which, yeah, sand don't do that. Sand just don't hover in the air like that. So that you knew that was something. And then there's pictures of somewhere there's like an offset to one of them and you can see something in it. Well, the reason I found this so fascinating is, one, if it survived for millions of years on Mars and didn't break, it's got to be something made out of something supremely more advanced than anything we have here. And it could have been transportation. It could have been aquifer. Reason people were so interested in it suggested that there was advanced life on Mars, which may have been 50 million years ago, may not have been. We don't know for sure what was on Mars because for some reason we refuse to send any people there. Rovers are great, but you know they can only do so much exploration. And rovers don't always pick out something. They may see something, but something else that a human might, oh, wait a minute, I need to go look at that. Rover might just snap a picture and move on. So it's a different, you know, human exploration is much different than robotic exploration. Yes, it's more dangerous for us, but as a society, we would appreciate the human part of this. It's going to happen in our future. Elon Musk is going to make it happen. This man is crazy. I mean, I told everybody 30 years ago, you ever want to see humans get in space, privatize the industry, and that's what they're doing. Now, where it used to take us 10 years to develop a spaceship in between, these guys are developing in 4 or 5 years, and not just one company, but five companies. Sierra Nevada's doing it, Boeing's doing it, Lockheed's doing it, NASA's funding all kind of people. I mean, this is something we've just never seen. So we're going to get into space. From this point forward, things are going to move much faster than they have been in the past. Now, Jack wanted to know if you thought humans were ready for colonization of any kind.
So it's very interesting because I'm a Canadian and we're speaking today on Canada Day. And one of the issues that we deal with is Canada existed a long time before there was the Dominion of Canada. There were people here, Indigenous people first. And even those Indigenous people, of course, as all of us did, originated in Africa. They came up through Eurasia, crossed over the Bering Land Bridge that existed, you know, the Alaskan Panhandle is the little bit of that that's left that existed across the Bering Strait in the last ice age. They colonized the land. And then 10,000 years later, we came and colonized the land. We meaning my own ancestors,
European. Recolonized.
So we're a colonizing species. We were born in Africa. Homo sapiens getting on over 100,000 years ago, probably not 200,000, but over 100, in Africa, and we colonized the world. Are we ready to colonize other worlds? Of course we are. It's in our DNA.
Yes, too.
We have wanderlust. In fact, one of the reasons why we're here and the Neanderthals were not, the Neanderthals also evolved, you know, we have a common ancestor with them. They came out of Africa as well, right? Their ancestor and our ancestor came out of Africa. They came around and they were looking across the Strait of Gibraltar from the north side, never bothered to cross down to the south to come back into Africa. We came up, Homo sapiens, as opposed to Homo neanderthalensis, up through Africa to the south side of the Strait of Gibraltar, looked across and said, there's a whole other world on the other side. We have to cross. We are an expansionist species. You can love us for it. You can hate us for it. But it's who we are.
It is who we are.
There will be men and women on Mars this century without question. Oh, there might be men and women on Mars this decade.
There might be. At the rate they're moving, there might be. I know Elon's already planning on sending cargo ships there starting in 2018. So,
right. This is the thing, of course, that it's the human part. That's the difficult part, getting us there alive. Getting cargo there, send it ahead. Absolutely. Send as much stuff that can take as long as you want to get there. Slow transfer orbits to Mars. You don't have to worry about radiation poisoning for most of it. Send it there. Get it there. And then you have to get us there as quickly as possible because space travel is hazardous. People get crazy, as we've all seen during COVID-19, when you're locked up in a tin can or your house for months on end. Yes, we should be seeding our proposed landing site right now with the goods, materials, supplies that are going to be needed when we arrive there. We don't have to take it all in our carry-on luggage as we go.
Well, most people don't realize that everybody thought the Apollo program was built to go to the moon. Actually, it wasn't, guys. Originally, your boy wanted to go to Mars. The moon was supposed to be a stepping stone to get us to Mars. But for some reason, NASA halfway through the project decided, no, we don't want to go to Mars. And then no one could figure out why we quit going to the moon. I know why we quit going to the moon. No, it didn't have anything to do with aliens. the reason we quit going back to the moon, there was nothing there for us. Today we understand about helium-3 and stuff, so there is a reason for us to go back now, because we can set up mines. Yeah, helium-3 is an extremely powerful substance, but it's not here, it's up there. So we got to go up there and mine and bring it home and do the whole nine yards. So yeah, you will start seeing that. I mean, there's already people already planning on setting this up. And then there's another thing that most people don't realize: space tourism. The Japanese have requested to put a hotel in orbit now. Oh yeah, people. And three companies, including Sierra Nevada, are building ships. You know, they can land out at, where's the spaceport? In Arizona, right? No, is it New Mexico?
New Mexico.
And yeah, they've been doing test landings out there. So Virgin Airlines just landed their craft there just the other day. They want to take you to space, people. They want you, because let's be honest, every astronaut I've ever interviewed, and I've talked to a few over the years, because when I used to go to D.C. to lecture, a couple of them were there, including Mega Itchel and a few of the other ones that I got to meet. Every one of them said the same thing. When you see Earth from space, you get a whole different attitude, it just changes the way you view the planet. So if humans start getting up there and actually seeing it, we may get a more peaceful environment at a much faster rate, at least I hope anyway. I can't see where it's going to hurt us. That's for damn sure. So what was that? No, we'll get into that on another day. No, because we don't have enough time for that. And next time I bring Robert on, we'll broach those subjects. The reason they brought this up is when you were talking about how we got to this continent. Recently, we were doing I do blood type research and DNA research. And we found out something that was really weird. Did you know that Central America and South America is 98% O blood? I'm O myself too, but I'm actually O negative. But
me too, the universal donor, you and me.
Universal donor, most important type of blood on the planet, by the way, guys, because it's where all of our hemological research come from. It's the purest form of blood known to man. And guess this, we share no common ancestry with the rhesus monkey like positive does. It's a different thing, and it's a real weird thing, but no one could figure out why Central and South America, because in North America, it's not like that. It's your regular breakdown of blood types, just like it is around the world. But for some reason, these two areas, so they got to thinking that maybe O originated on this continent and moved forward. So now they're thinking there's two separate evolutions of man, because there's also a set of skulls in South America that are different than ours. So they're thinking it may have been a second evolution of man in South America. So guys, don't even get arguing about that. It'll be 100 years before there's any science to back this up. Other than the blood type research and some DNA research, there are long ways from proving this. It's a great topic and it's a fun topic to talk about, but science-based, we're going to do the iffy thing and leave it at that. I don't know. And I agree. I mean, when I had brought some DNA experts on, because there's an argument about what it takes to have a healthy population. So we know for a fact that we didn't come from two parents, because half the population today would be inbred or retarded or something along those lines. Anytime you breed back to the same population, you risk brilliance, but you also risk a lot of other health issues and mental issues. That's just science fact. So what they're telling us is it takes a voluble population of 7,600 to create a one being. So for the current population on this planet today, which is 7.4 billion, I think, you would have had to start out with about 86,000 people, which means there's no way 86,000 people formed in the plains in Africa. The lions would have ate them. The apes would have ate them. It would have been too large of a population. So what it looks like, and what they're deciding today is it looks like man may have sprung up on several places on the planet and then met, bred, and interbred, and then created a more healthy population that expanded later on. We don't know. It's not science fiction, but it's not science fact either. It's just a theory. Well, evolution's a theory, guys. They still haven't proved it. Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of evolution. I'm not even going to argue with y'all, but they haven't proved it. It's still a theory. Don't ask me why I'm not a scientist. I don't prove evolution. I would like them to get a square divide on evolution so we can move on and talk about other things involved with evolution. But for some reason, this is a fight that sometimes I just wonder why it's a fight. I mean, some things you can clearly see evolution on this planet. Some things, yeah, like the platypus. I don't know what the hell a platypus. That was God's joke at us. He said, let me make this thing to give y'all some humor. See, even he believed or she believed in humor. I don't want it to, but I know we got to get out.
I mean, the platypus is one of the two extant mammals that lay eggs. The other one is the echidna, and that clearly shows that we and egg-laying animals have a common ancestor. We evolved, mammals evolved from reptiles. There's no question about that. Reptiles evolved from amphibians. Amphibians evolved from fish. We have, you know, I said there's no question about that, except that everything in science is provisional. If you find a piece of evidence that contradicts what we thought we knew, the beauty of science is everybody will start scratching their head and try to figure out, can we fit it in or do we have to start over? Do we have, you know, we used to think, as Darwin did, that evolution was gradual, step by step by step, very tiny, and it would be a constant process. And then we discovered Stephen Jay Gould being one of the principal speakers about that. No, it goes in jumps. A species will be stable for millions of years, and then an environmental crisis will happen, or a new predator will appear on the scene and change the balance of power, and then there'll be a leap. We call it punctuated equilibrium. Equilibrium, and then a punctuation in it where it changes. So evolution, even that, is a work in progress. But we're always open to new ideas, new interpretations, and never dismiss, but always look at the freshest evidence.
Jack said, look, first off, Jack, every human does have a reptilian section in your brain, and it's a very significant part of us. Don't ever think it's not. It's a lot of who and what humans are comes from that little bit of reptilian in us. But so it comes from the reptilian aliens. So, hey, look, maybe they came here and interbred with man. I don't know. I wasn't alive back then, people. I can only go by what's going on today. If I see a reptilian wanting to sleep with me, we're going to have an issue. I'm just telling y'all. Just know off the... No, I'm not going to hate on him. I'm probably going to shoot him. So just to let you know ahead of time, reptilians, stay away from me. Robert said y'all can come visit him if y'all want to write some books. But other than that, stay away. Robert, tell him again where you can get your books. Oh, we're going to bring Robert back because we got way short, and I really wanted to get into some other stuff with him. I wanted to get more into some of his other books because I'm looking at his titles while we're speaking. And y'all, if you're looking, watching some video, which I don't know where everybody is tonight, but if you're watching us on video and or if you're watching us later on after the show re-airs, all his titles are right here. And of course, you can go to the website and look at them. But, you know, you can come by, take a look at these, like the Golden Fleece. Looks like it's going to be interesting. These are the dinosaur books right here. What is it? Four of these in here? And y'all can get in there. I'm personally interested in the Red Planet Blues. Quantum Night sounds interesting. He's talking about nighttime, not night. We brought that up earlier. This one right here, I can't see the title, but I like the cover on it. It kind of looks like a woman's face and an alien's face, but I can't tell what it is because for some reason my screen's too small. I see we got humans, hybrids. There's a lot of interesting stuff in here, guys. Really and truly, there's a couple of good titles in here that I see. I would get in here, guys, and look around. Starplex, I don't know what's in Starplex. I haven't read it. Mark wanted to know, can you get all these books in audio or some of them? Or
everyone, every single one of them.
There you go. See, I can tell you now, I'll be. I'll end up listening to all of them now that I can get an audio. Well, people, I'm going to tell you what I did. When I'm working on the computers or I got shows on that I'm not interested in the topic of the show, I will cue it up and listen to something else. Or if I'm driving, a lot of times I will just put my phone on and throw it to my speakers on my car and listen. And it's nice. It keeps me distracted while I'm driving. I don't mean distracted where I can't drive, people. I just mean distracted from whatever I'm thinking about. But I know we got to go because the Outer Realm's coming up. Michelle DeRoche is going to kick me in the butt. She's a Canadian. I thought they were going to take off today since it was Canada Day, but I guess not. Canada Day is like 4th of July, whoever just asked that dumb question. No, it is. It's their I guess, their version of the 4th of July. Isn't that right? Yeah, I was just making
sure. The first day of the country. Exactly. Yeah. The first day of the country.
So if you're in Canada, happy Canuck Day. And for everybody else, I hope y'all are enjoying yourself. I hope y'all enjoyed the show. Like I said, we will have him back. I'm going to get with Carmen and talk about maybe in August sometime. I think the first date open we got is like the 26th or something. But y'all don't know who Carmen is. Y'all don't worry about that. Robert does. Whoever just asked that question, who's Carmen? Nobody y'all need to know. unless you're – he's no, you don't know who he is. Don't worry about it.
Carmen's one of my publicists, and he is a bulldog.
Yes. Carmen keeps us all on our toes, and he does a lot of guest booking for them, and he always makes sure I have everything I need when we have a guest on. Oh, yeah, that's where that photo right there came from. Yeah, you see that? Yeah, it's great. But, guys, go check out – I mean, he's got a wide range of books on here. I see quite a few interesting topics in here. I imagine they're all good if you got time to go through them. And remember, people – It's July, so guess what? Christmas is 5 months away. Speaking of that, I'm glad I said that. Since you're an author, usually we bring authors back in November so they have a chance to sell their books for Christmas. So I may double book you. So anyway, I would give a comment on all that stuff. But guys, we got to get out of here. I know we're up against the clock. We should have ended 5 minutes ago, but we started late because of the electrical issues. Robert, you've been great. I really enjoyed this. There's a whole bunch of other sci-fi in your books and some other stuff I want to talk to you about, but I have to get you back on for that. Yeah, no. Well, fellow sci-fi people are hard to find when you're doing this, man. I mean, some people look at sci-fi like it's a plague or something. Yeah, I don't, you know, anybody who doesn't like sci-fi, I would go seek psychiatric help. That's all I can tell you. You're missing part of the, because sci-fi not just has the science fiction stuff, but it incorporates so many life lessons into it. And it's a great thing for children. Well, some sci-fi, some of it might be above children's heads, but like Altered Carbon, do not want your kids to watch that movie. I mean, that series, whatever you do, don't let them watch that series. Oh my God, no. And if you're easily embarrassed, don't watch it. I'm just telling y'all. But we got to go again. Robert, thanks, man. You were great. Guys, Galaxy Press, Ron L. Harbin's, what are we on, volume 37 now?
Yeah, I guess that's right. That's right, yes.
So
of Writers of the Future, the contest and the anthology that comes out of it each year with our winners in it from the Writers of the Future contest and the Illustrators of the Future contest. All that info at writersofthefuture.com.
Yeah, and all those links are up on our site. Guys, it's a great. Those are great because there's 12 stories in there, plus some addition of some other stuff that they include in there. So I would get it. It's well worth the read. Well, there's 12 stories. I guarantee you're going to like one of them. Oh, yeah, I can guarantee you that. Well, because they don't just take BS writers. They actually, no, see, he's you just heard me talking with Robert and what we were discussing. So you know he's well-versed in sci-fi and other stuff. So, yes, he's going to judge you fairly. He's not going to know who you are. He's not going to know your book. He's not going to know any of this stuff. So, you know, it's just one of those things, guys. But anyway, we got to get out of here and let the girls get on and get their show going. And their guest tonight is I just had it in front of me. Dun, 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 dun. Well, I just had it in front of me. I guess I don't anymore, but let's see. Come on, where'd it go? Paul Cecil and Tony Ferguson will be on tonight with them, so they'll be discussing a wide range of topics with them. So we got to go. Robert, thanks again, man. You were fabulous. I'll get with Carmen, get you rebooked. Guys and girls, stay tuned for The Outer Realm with Michelle DeRocher and Amelia Pisano. When that's whipping coming. We gotta go. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye, Joe.
Oh, man, it's too much.
At JCPenney, we know you miss us, and we miss you. So, what if we said we had a store that's open all day, every day? We do. It's jcp.com or the JCPenney app. Need a swimsuit? We've got them. Something new and cute for summer? Look no further. Exclusive JCPenney brands, plus your favorite national brands? Yes and yes. Check our site for the latest coupons, and when you spend $49 or more, standard shipping is free. JCPenney. Exclusions apply. See jcp.com for details.